Welcome to another Rock'em Sock'em in your mommy's face edition of the Every Joe podcast. EveryJoe.com, hashtag EJPC, your political safe space. I am Brodigan. I want to apologize for that we missed you guys last week. It was, let's just say, it was one of those weeks in politics where we couldn't get three people in the room together that actually wanted to talk to each other, which actually includes me, included me with our producers. But we actually have a great show this week. It's an important show for me because there's a besides all the number of other things that we're all getting disgusted with politics over lately, one of it seems to be what we'll just say various aspects of the conservative media has become. You may have seen one particular website in the news lately, but there are a couple sites that do a lot of great work, and I have people from two of my favorites with us, my absolute favorites with us today, which is the Federalist and the Free Beacon. So make sure everyone goes to thefederalist.com and freebeacon.com. And when you do, if you go to one of them, you'll see you'll read stuff from the publisher of the Free Beacon and also the editor of the Transom, which is the newsletter we all start our morning with every day. Ben Dominich, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And over from the freebeacon.com side, an intrepid reporter. If there's dark money that Democrats are trying to cover up, his name is probably in a security guard's hand saying if he shows up, beat him up and just don't let him find out who's at our meeting. Lachlan Marquet, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I guess to start off, I mean, you know, like, there's a lot of important issues. You know, we've got the bombing in Brussels. We've got the, you know, the presidential race and, like, oh my God, Ted Cruz quoted a movie and, you know, the worst thing to happen in 2016. But I think we have to start off with a tragic story, and that's the passing of former Toronto Mayor Rob Ford. I was going to say we should all do a line of blow on the show for him. Unfortunately, that didn't get past corporate. But Ben, your thoughts on the loss of this great, great man?
So Rob Ford was a great man, and I'm not actually kidding about that. And there's a piece on thefederalist.com by Molly Hemingway yesterday that we ran, and she went through what his mayoral experience actually looked like. And I think people would be surprised. This was not just kind of a buffoonish figure, hero of the working man type. He was a guy who actually, when he got in office, you know, took on the unions, took on corruption in politics, cut taxes, balanced budgets, and was actually kind of a pretty good fiscally conservative type. And to be honest, the thing that I really took away from it is we would be so lucky to have Donald Trump as president if he was more like Rob Ford. Rob Ford is what he should be like. I mean, that would be great in so many different respects.
Okay,
and it'd be entertaining. So frankly, you know, if there's anything, I hope that if or when Trump is nominated and becomes president, that he emulates Ford very particularly, especially down, of course, to that famous image of him standing apart from the clapping rally at an announcement speech, looking like he's about to fall over completely high. And I hope that is something like what a Trump administration would look like, because at least it would be entertaining.
Yeah. So Lachlan, apparently it was a case of the buffoonery kind of got in the way of the fact that he was an incompetent elected official. And if I had to choose between him and the current mayor of New York City, I would definitely take Rob Ford, it sounds like.
I mean, I do wonder how, you know, it didn't seem calculated, this whole persona that he would put on. It seemed very authentic, and you know, it's hard to feign a drug addiction of the potency that it seemed that he had. But you do wonder whether he was, I mean, you know, the same sources of his popularity to the extent that he was popular are what we're seeing in Donald Trump right now. So, you know, you kind of have to wonder if some of this was an act that he was putting on to kind of put on that that blue collar sort of everyman persona. You know, I, like Ben said, you know, the entertainment factor was huge. And, you know, we certainly enjoyed watching him south of the border. I would imagine those Toronto residents watching maybe were not so enthusiastic about some of his antics. But, you know, he had that figured out. This whole, you know, politics is a circus. It's a total media show. And he had mastered that before really, you know, anyone else before Donald Trump, I think.
And actually, I mean, this is a good segue when you bring up politics as a circus. because when talking about the Brussels, the terror attack in Brussels, where I think, you know, the big story should be the fact that, you know, it was another ISIS attack and may or may not have been retaliation to the fact that they just caught the person who was one of the people responsible for the Paris attack. And it seems that instead of talking about that, we're talking about the fact that while this was going on, our president was in Cuba smoking a cigar and drinking like a fruity tropical drink, or we have people talking about that Ted Cruz said something mean about Muslims after, you know, Islamic extremists committed another terror attack. But my personal favorite, and this goes into the some of the media buffoonery that we were just talking about. Apparently, Donald Trump said something at some point over the past couple of years that, well, Brussels might be a problem, and everyone's claiming that this is proof that he should be in charge of a foreign policy, up to and including the women on The View.
You gotta laugh.
Ben?
You know, so the thing that I find, look, I mean, what's interesting about what happened in the Brussels situation is that it explains very well why you've seen the rise of the populist right in Europe and why you've seen the rise of populist rightist movements generally across the world, because it's a situation that was put in place by, you know, the ruling class, the elites in Europe, who decided that they were going to take on these significant Muslim populations over the course of years as a replacement, effectively, for the fact that they were not producing the number of children necessary to fulfill the jobs that they needed to fill in their countries. And so they import a lot of labor at first, and then you have the refugee population that has followed in recent years. And the difference in attitude is this: when we come to America, when you come to America, or at least traditionally, when you come to America, not in all pockets, there's an expectation that you are becoming an American, that you are going to assimilate into our culture, that you are going to salute the flag, that you owe your allegiance to the Constitution, and that it owes its protections to you and the government to secure those liberties. The difference in Europe is very significant. In Europe, you have an expectation that doesn't run toward assimilation. In fact, assimilation as such is viewed as being something that is gauche or untoward, or, you know, unacceptable to demand of these people who are coming in, because that's an act of that almost rings of colonialism of the past or something like that. So what you end up with is these significant ghettoized, segregated populations of people who have a unity of language, who have a unity of faith, and create these little pockets that allow sort of these young Muslim men to kind of fester and to be sympathetic to the kind of message that ISIS and other organizations can have. And now you have a situation in Europe where there really are these significant cells where Europeans don't have the resources. Brussels certainly doesn't have the resources to engage the kind of human intelligence necessary to figure out where all these cells are working, where, you know, what they're doing. And that's how you have a criminal like this most recent terrorist who was arrested able to avoid detection for so long, relying on those networks. It's a terrible situation. It's one that the elites and leadership allowed to happen, and explains generally the real reason that you've seen the rise of these movements that say this is unacceptable, we have to stop.
And if I could add to that, you know, the United States, to a lesser degree, but still, there's sort of a similar impulse to, you know, obviously we have a significant immigrant population in this country, and that, you know, when you have a very large welfare state like Europe does, and to a lesser degree, but still a significant degree, the United States does, and a birth rate that's too small to have the workers to sort of pay for those programs, you need to sort of compensate for that. So while Europe has sort of looked east to do that, the United States obviously has looked south. And I think Mexican immigrants and Central and South American immigrants have a far greater degree of cultural and historical overlap with the United States than do Arab immigrants or North African immigrants with Western Europe. And obviously there's not as this, you know, this massive movement in South American or Mexican communities that's determined to completely overthrow and replace the United States government. So just by virtue of the, you know, the characteristics of the various immigrant populations, we're just not going to see the same sort of radicalization that they do in Europe. And, you know, to Ben's other point, as far as like the delegitimization of institutions goes, eventually, you know, and that we see that in the rise of these radical right parties, you know, we're really only one major, I hate to call it a right-wing terrorist because that's such a loaded term, but one major, let's say, anti-Arab or anti-Muslim act of violence in Europe away from, you know, war in the streets, in my opinion. And eventually European citizens or a large enough number of them are going to conclude that their government is unwilling or incapable of defending them, and they're going to take it into their own hands. And that's when you start seeing, you know, mass violence in the streets. And I think that, you know, that would have sounded crazy a few years ago, and it's not a remote possibility.
Can I jump in on that? Because Lachlan, I agree with you. I think you're right. And I think a lot of that has to do with the kind of very basic local level revolts that we've seen. The footage of meetings, of town meetings, where you have parents talking about the inability of their children, particularly their daughters, to walk home from school because they're passing by neighborhoods where men, you know, feel perfectly free to treat them like dogs and to rape them and to engage in all sorts of violence against them. That sort of stuff, that's the thing that makes that makes communities just explode historically, and with good reason, if they feel like their government is not doing what they expect it to do.
Yeah, and that's I think that's also I'll get both of your thoughts on this. Obviously not that major, because we don't have as many of these attacks here that's happening in Europe, but it's one of those things that I think a lot of people point to the rise of the popularity of Donald Trump. Well, I mean, everything the two of you both said about immigration makes perfect sense, absolute perfect logical sense. And unfortunately, we seem to get into an argument where, I mean, you have an extreme on one side where honestly think like, well, this country's being invaded by, you know, brown people, but then you have the extreme on the other side, which seems to be the, you know, one entire political party, most in the media, where anytime there is an attack, their biggest concern isn't the attack. It isn't the fact that parents are afraid to send their kids to school because the people sympathetic to the attackers are threatening them and threatening to rape them, and or worse. The biggest problem is the fact that, oh, well, when these attacks happen, we have to be careful not to fall into Islamophobia. And, you know, we need to be more concerned about that, you know, than with the killing.
Yeah, but see, that's a perfect example of a situation that basically happened in Europe, in the sense that they were so fearful of being described as Islamophobic because they wanted to, you know, basically if they had wanted to have these new communities of people assimilate, that they went away from that, and now they're, you know, left with a situation where they have kind of a nation within a nation and not really one of their own. So that's a real problem for them. And I agree with Lachlan's concerns about Europe. When it comes to Trump, though, you know, the comments that he's been making of late regarding foreign policy, particularly the interview that he did with the Washington Post editorial page, I have a lot of people when it comes to his attitude toward the world. I mean, basically dismissing the idea that we need NATO anymore, that, you know, our European allies, you know, don't matter in that degree. I'm all fine with saying Europe should pay for more of its own defense. You know, it should be 2% of GDP or whatever that they're putting towards in order to balance against Russia. But his basically casual dismissal of you know, any kind of alliance, you know, across the Atlantic that needs to balance against Putin's interests and priorities is just the sort of thing that I think when you look at him, you have to say, you know, is this guy really all that serious? I'm not sure how serious you can really take, you know, any of his positions on any given day for more than a few seconds at a time. And it's concerning to me because I feel like we really don't have any idea what we're going to get. I do think that if he's president, he'll be a successful president, a popular president. I also think he'll be a very progressive president. So that's something we should, it'll be interesting to watch, especially if he, you know, ends up moving in that direction, if he gets into a general.
Yeah. Okay. And Lachlan, let's segue to, speaking of Trump, let's segue to the presidential race.
Sure.
And this is especially when, I guess, Ben mentions, and I think there's a lot of concerns about him being a progressive president. So we've got the Wisconsin primary in 2 weeks, and we've got the New York primary 2 weeks after that. And I was talking with a New York guy who was actually a Scott Walker supporter, because we were discussing what we thought Walker was going to do. And we found it interesting that Walker was one of the first to drop out of the presidential race, specifically saying, you all need to drop out, except for maybe two of you who have like an actual campaign and a chance to do anything, because if we don't drop out, we're never going to be able to rally around and to be able to stop Donald Trump. And now here we are, however many months later, no one listened to him. And now we found people trying to, in a panic, rushing around Ted Cruz because he's all we got left. It's not a knock on Ted Cruz, but it's just a matter of the fact that he's all we've got left. I mean, is it fait accompli at this point, or I mean, are we looking at like a riots at the convention?
You know, virtually every prediction that I have made in the past year politically has been wrong. So I've learned that I probably shouldn't make predictions. But I think in terms of the past 6 months, it's the sum of all fears for people like me who don't support Donald Trump and will never support Donald Trump. I have stopped trying to pretend or put on this air of speaking for really anyone else, the Republican Party, the conservative movement. I can only say for my part that, I won't support him, and come what may, and if that means the Republican Party is destroyed, well, it didn't really matter what I was going to do in the first place. So that's where I'm at. I'm resigned to it. As a reporter, I figure, hey, worst case scenario, if it's Trump versus Hillary, we have the biggest corruption scandal since Watergate, no matter who wins, and I get a chance to report on that. So that's basically what I'm at.
The silver linings, Lachlan.
Oh, and there is a good chance to plug my book coming out in early 2017. So if Hillary wins, I get to write about her, and that's always easier. So
nice. Okay. Well, there you go.
Yep.
So, Ben, how about you? And actually, specifically, talk to us about the Hamilton rule.
So, for me, the perspective that I have on this is just that I think that both Hillary and Donald Trump are bad for America. They're bad in different ways. Neither of them believe in the Constitution. Neither of them really believe in the right to free speech. I do think, though, that there is an argument that can be made and that will be made on the basis that if Donald Trump is the choice, if there is a clear choice between the two, and by 15 points, which he easily could be doing in the fall, that you have to hold your nose and vote for Trump because of the likelihood, that 100% certainty that Hillary Clinton would appoint a bad justice to the Supreme Court, and maybe only, 75% certainty, 80% certainty that Donald Trump would do the same. So I think a lot of Republicans will make that argument. And it's one that I understand and sympathetic to. But I think that's going to be kind of a moot point if the polls are what they are, which kind of is, Donald Trump losing to Hillary 38-46, and some independent candidate, bringing in a lot of support, 10-15% of support from a lot of the people on Trump's right flank who are unwilling to come around to him. He's going to have to deal with that, and we'll see how he does respond to that. Because if he doesn't have those people, he can very well lose, and lose by quite a bit. The Hamilton rule back in 2013, and it extends back to the decision that Alexander Hamilton was faced with at the end of the Adams administration, the first 4 years of it, where he had to decide between support for Adams, who was in his own party and was a Federalist, but who had been proven time and again to be a temperamental, foolish, foolhardy executive, someone who Hamilton didn't respect, who his allies did not respect, who they thought was not going to be someone who was a good president for the next 4 years, and they thought would actually dim their electoral prospects, for years to come if they supported him. Hamilton wrote to a friend at the time about it, and obviously the foe that Adams was facing in the election at that time was a rematch against Thomas Jefferson, who was no friend of Hamilton, who Hamilton, never got along with, and who he was at odds basically his entire life on just about everything. And yet Hamilton supported him because he said, if we must have an enemy at the head of government, let it be one whom we can oppose, for whom we are not responsible. who will not involve our party in the disgrace of his foolish and bad measure. Yet the Federalist, Tom Nichols, who's one of our senior contributors, is of the same mind as well when it comes to the general election. He's already written a piece saying that if he's forced to choose between Trump and Hillary, he will choose Hillary for that reason, because he believes that that's an opportunity for conservatives to rally together and that we will not own her mistakes the way that Republicans would presumably own Donald Trump's.
Now, Ben, I wanted to get your thoughts on something that I read in Matt Labash's profile of Mike Murphy in the Weekly Standard this week, which was
great profile.
And I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote from it, unfortunately. But what Murphy said at one point, and this honestly was the best Republican case for Hillary against Trump that I've seen to date. And it was essentially, you know, with Hillary, you know, you're talking about an election and potentially another 4 to 8 years in the wilderness, a Supreme Court justice probably. With Trump, you're talking about irreparably harming America's standing in the world, potentially destroying the dollar as the world's reserve currency. You know, you have powers cashing in their debts with America's central banks when they realize or they feel that they can't rely on America as a stable world power anymore. I mean, do you see those concerns? And you know, I ask this totally honestly as a as a conservative, should we be thinking twice about, you know, staying neutral or, you know, just saying so with Trump?
So a couple of things. First off, to your point about predictions, who the heck knows? I have no idea what his presidency looks like. You know, I mean, you know, does he, his current, you know, sort of the people who are around him, who are in orbit right now around him, are Newt Gingrich, Bill Bennett, you know, Mike Huckabee to a degree, the, you know, Chris Christie, Steve Forbes seems to be open to him, Steve Moore from the Heritage Foundation, you know, a couple of others, and they're all giving him advice. Who's to say that he listens? You know, who's to say that he listens at all? He may not listen to them at all. He may just listen to himself, just like he does in foreign policy. And so we could be like, the case that I would probably make in response to what Murphy's saying is Donald Trump lives and dies based on popularity. His most important priority is his personal popularity. He confuses it, honestly, with his net worth. And that's why he has these huge, you know, brand numbers, because he says basically what he's saying is my name and my presence is worth $2 billion, just flat out, you know, like forget everything else.
And unfortunately, the press is saying that also.
Yes, unfortunately. But here's the thing. He's going to want to be popular. And so from my perspective, he's actually in office going to do everything that he thinks that the people want. And what does that look like? You know, it probably does look like building a wall just because he's promised it. But on immigration policy otherwise, you know, he might go a little shaky. What does it look like when it comes to, you know, economic policy and foreign affairs, things of that nature? If people want him to go to war somewhere, he's going to do it. Okay, and if they don't want him to go to war somewhere, he's not going to try to convince them. He's just going to do whatever they want. And so as a pure engine of populism, I feel like you just have to kind of say, basically the question is for somebody like Murphy, you know, why would he really do that in a situation where that would make him unpopular? He's only interested in sustaining that. And so the other thing is, frankly, that Trumpism, if he is the nominee and loses, I think is not actually something that's going to become part of the Republican coalition. So if he loses, I think it's very tied to him and only leaves a little bit of residue in a way that the Tea Party otherwise, you know, became part of the Republican coalition and remains a key part of them. I think that Trumpism and everything that represents kind of drifts away sort of goes back into the disaffected camp. But if he's the nominee and wins, that means that he's built a big enough tent in order to do something that John McCain couldn't and that Mitt Romney couldn't. And we have to respect that to a degree and basically recognize the Republican Party is a lot less conservative than we thought it was. It's a lot more secular than we thought it was. And we as conservatives or libertarians or people who really care about ideology, we're going to have to kind of view our role as being the loyal opposition. People, Trump, keeping him honest to the degree that we can, trying to craft policies that, you know, solve problems that he cares about and sell it to him based on pure personal ambition. This will make you more popular, as opposed to saying this is constitutional or this is conservative. That's a long answer, but I guess basically what I'm saying is if he becomes president, I just don't think it's going to be quite as bad as anybody's saying. I think it's going to look a lot like, frankly, I think he is and really most resembles Silvio Berlusconi from Italy. You know, I think he's a corrupt, you know, old guy with a fetish for young women who is certainly, you know, going to be a problem in all of those different respects, and vulgar and crude. But he's also a guy who I think once Berlusconi's, the name of Berlusconi's party is literally Go Italy. And that's basically what Donald Trump is. He's just a guy shouting Go America. And, you know, everybody's standing up for that this year.
Yeah. But when it comes to being loyal opposition, I mean, how does that look? Especially when I think that this goes to some, a lot of the frustration of those of us who are on the Never Trump camp. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, we've spent the past 8 years being loyal opposition and trying to build up all these other candidates so that way when it came time to run, you know, everyone keeps throwing on the establishment this and the establishment that, but the you know, the goal was supposed to be to have, you know, Rubio or Cruz, Scott Walker, Rand Paul, Rick Perry, all these people taking over the establishment and pulling us to the right. And then as soon as someone new and shiny came along, a lot of those people look to as being like the thought leaders on the right decided to jump ship and go with this other guy who was a complete contradiction to everything they said was like acceptable or not acceptable for the past couple of years. And when it comes to being a loyal opposition, it seems to be when, I mean, forget about on policy and forget about complaining about him. If you don't praise him, you know, mm-hmm. you're an elitist and your opinion's worthless. I mean, Ben, you're an elitist. Lachlan, yep. you're an elitist. The Weekly Standard are elitist. As I'm sitting in my basement apartment in like the South Shore of Long Island, I'm an elitist.
You're very elitist.
Yeah, I'm very elitist. I mean, what exactly does like a loyal opposition even look like?
So, from my perspective, a loyal opposition is one that understands that the position now for conservatives and for libertarians would be, all right, we are actually, you know, a portion of a party that is less conservative than we are. So we've got to figure out ways to advance conservative policy by perhaps speaking more directly to their concerns. And one of the, you know, an example of that I would give is something like, you know, there's a lot of reform conservatives and myself and other people have written about, you know, the need for tax policy that extends more into the working class and that isn't as much about, you know, the sort of traditional approach to Republican tax cutting. Well, cut the payroll tax. Does two things. Number one, it gives a tax cut to every working American. It also gives puts us in a situation where we have to confront the fact that this payroll tax system is not actually going in to fund the entitlement system in the way that it's supposed to. You know, the idea of it being, you know, a trust fund or a lockbox or something like that. That's an example of a policy that you could have that would be popular, that would be conservative, but that you wouldn't sell to Donald Trump on a conservative basis. You'd just sell it on, hey, you know, day one in office, you can give a tax cut to every working American man. And popular. And that's something that, you know, is sort of the way that I think we'll have to approach it, is being tactical in those ways. The thing is, though, we're speaking about an era in which the party, for as many people who are writing about it, like dying or going away, it has 30 governorships. It has all these state houses. It has, you know, majorities in both houses of Congress. It's got dynamic young figures, including, I mean, you know, frankly, whatever you think of Ted Cruz, he's a smart young guy. Whatever you think of Paul Ryan, he's a smart young guy. Whatever you think of Ben Sasse, he's a smart young guy. You know, whatever you think of, you know, in terms of their actual policies, you can go down the list. And the Republican Party of today looks a heck of a lot better than it did from my perspective back in 2004 to 2006, when you had completely, you know, older leadership and just people making the trains run on time and people content to sort of try to just be politics as usual. I think it's a lot better now for a lot of reasons. And so because of that, you know, even though people may feel down about the rise of Trump, people listening to this, the optimism I would give you is you're not talking about a party that's actually dead. You're talking about a party that's being taken over by a nationalist populist figure and balancing and working against him, figuring out ways to force him to box him in and force him into positions where he's endorsing conservative policy and wants to, is not necessarily a bad thing.
To Brodigan's point, though, you know, the conservative movement of 2010 to 2012, like 2009 to 2012, to the extent there was, you know, the uniting cause was really opposition to Obamacare, but to the extent that there was a uniting positive sort of agenda, it was probably entitlement reform was the big item. Paul Ryan, obviously, that was his big cause in those days. And, you know, so when we talk about sort of, if not making common cause, then at least banding together short term politically with the Trumps of the world. We're talking about, these are irreconcilable differences.
Yeah, that really is an irreconcilable difference, and it's going to be a real problem. I think one of the things that you could do, though, potentially, is you could see deals that worked in different directions. Like, for instance, I don't think Trump would have any objection necessarily to block granting Medicaid. You know, like that's not as sexy as the kind of, histogram, if you call a histogram sexy, reforms that Paul Ryan would like. But on the other score, I just think that there is an opportunity. There is an opportunity here to make force Trump into positions, I think, as president, where he would have to advocate for conservative policy. But that's going to take thinking tactically. It's not going to be the kind of unified front that I think you'd like to project. And that's in part because you didn't have a lot of these younger folks adapt early enough to the cycle in the way that they want. I think Marco Rubio is one of the most talented, politicians of his generation. But I think the fact is that in this cycle, the difference between him and Ted Cruz really is that Cruz's campaign at a certain point recognized that he needed to become kind of the authentic vehicle for Trumpism. And, you want these things. I'm going to give you some of it. But I'll be the one who's actually authentic. You can't trust, Donald on these issues because you can trust me. Where Rubio really stuck to his original message about a new generation of leadership and everything else, which is fine as a script, but I think just was out of step with the moment currently. I think the moment currently is not the entitlement reform, fiscal conservatism moment that we saw with the Tea Party. I think it's a much more populist, nationalist, America is weak. Obama's an authoritarian. We have immigrants taking our jobs, and this shiny haired man comes on TV and says he's going to make everything great again. And I like that. And adapting ourselves to that is something that's going to be a challenge because he's not a conservative and he doesn't believe in the Constitution. But we've got to be able to fight that, I think, within the Republican Party, given how many of these young, inspiring young figures have gotten elected in recent years that have really shifted the party in a more conservative and a much better direction, I think, rhetorically.
I just wonder if Trump simply as the vehicle for policy proposals makes them less likely to be achieved. So even if they're,
sure.
even if they're take immigration. In theory, I agree with immigration restrictions. It is not just within a country's right, but within its interests to limit the people who come into the country. And I think a very reasonable way to do that is to say, you are only getting in if you advance the financial or national security interests of the United States. That's not a racist position or xenophobic. That's totally rational. And I think it's something you could probably sell to most Americans. But when, in the way that Trump tries to sell immigration restrictions, if it does happen, in terms of policy, it's going to be so tremendously divisive that you're going to, either you're going to open up massive divisions that are going to make future political gains harder, or that policy itself is going to be extremely difficult to put through. So, even in those areas where we can cooperate with him, I see him being as, a tremendously bad political partner to try to get this stuff through.
Well, I think you're right about that. However, I think that what that would actually do is make, taking again your issue of immigration, Trump negotiates from the extreme. Okay, that's the way he approaches deal making. It's the way he's approached this election, frankly. He's negotiated from the extremes with an electorate made up of Republicans and disaffected Democrats. And in practice, I think he would end up having a more moderate position on a lot of these policy fronts. The thing is, Trump is his own animal. And I think that if he's the face of the party, if he does take the nomination, if Cruz is not able to stop him, and I still think there's time for Cruz to stop him. If you see the kind of momentum play out as it did, over the course of the past a couple of weeks, in which, frankly, I think Trump's momentum has stalled a little bit, which is why I think you're seeing the kind of activity lately on social media and otherwise from him, is that he knows that there is an opportunity, I think, for people like Cruz, who's going to be in the Senate still, people like me, Mike Lee, people like Rand Paul and others, to essentially, put an agenda forward that achieves some of what Trump wants, but actually comes across as being more moderate than whatever it is that he's going to be proposing.
But I feel like that kind of illustrates my point, because what you're doing in that situation, when you start at the extreme and then sort of whittle your way down to an acceptable policy, is you're sacrificing political capital up front for a policy that's not going to satisfy your most ardent supporters in the long run.
Yes, which is, and that's the biggest danger with Trump, which is that he has promised so many things. He has promised everything is going to be wonderful, and he's going to fail to achieve that, which is why it's still such a mistake to nominate him, even though I see so many of these smart people saying, oh, no, this is fine. You know, this is going to be. The one thing I would say about Trump is a very stubborn man. He's very thin-skinned. He bears grudges, and he needs love. He needs a hug more than he needs anything else. I mean, the guy just has a hole inside him that he can't fill with anything but the love of these crowds. And I think that that's a very dangerous narcissistic personality to have in the White House and in that kind of role. I think it would be very bad. But I also have to say this. Hillary Clinton has a big hole inside her too. And the only way that she can fill it is with the achievement of power and the use of that power to crush her enemies. So that's the sort of thing that I think we have to recognize about this. Like, it's, you know, you're choosing between someone who's going to you know, audit everybody who you know was on the National Review cover and people and someone who's going to audit everybody who subscribes to National Review.
On that note, because we do gotta wrap up. Quick side note, and this is the warning to anyone watching. There's an article going around about John Kasich dropping out of the presidential race. It's from 1999. So if you see an article on Facebook about John Kasich dropping out, don't share it. I almost interrupted Lachlan with breaking news. Stop doing this stuff. Stop it. You're not helping anyone. But just to get everyone's closing thoughts, Lachlan, we'll start with you.
I don't think I've despaired as much in my professional career as I am this year. And it's changing the way that I look at politics, and not for the better. And it's making me a little sort of more detached from the institutions that I thought I was a part of and thought I was going to support and join and so on when I first got to Washington. We'll see how it turns out. I'm sure, Hillary Clinton as president would actually be good for me financially. So I can always take solace in that, I suppose.
Liberty always needs defenders. It always needs people who are going to fight, even if that fight is a guerrilla war. I'm actually a little more optimistic, and here's why. As much as I despise the person that Donald Trump is and everything that he represents, the people who support him, from my perspective, actually give me hope about the country. Because the thesis that Barack Obama had when he ran for president, and the one that he applied through Obamacare, was that if you just give entitlements to enough working class and middle class people, if you just bump that up, then they're going to defend those entitlements. They're going to be happy about those entitlements. They're going to want those entitlements, and they're going to become completely slavish to the welfare state. That's what they're going to want forever and forever. What's actually happening, though, is that the people who've received those benefits have not been accepting the Democratic leftist agenda as being the one that's in their best interest. That's why we saw Matt Bevin do so well in all of these different areas in Kentucky that had seen massive increases in the Medicaid population and things like that. It's because people, the Jacksonian core of the working class of America, that has always kind of rejected this view of what their life should be like, is looking into the Barack Obama agenda and just saying, this isn't good enough. We want to be great. We want better than this. We don't just want to be satisfied getting an entitlement, getting our food stamps, and just living our lives and having no real future. It's sad, but I think it's also better than the alternative, which is being completely disaffected, viewing our political process as so broken that they can't achieve anything, and walking away from the voting booth and from the citizenry entirely. So let's have a little hope for that. At least they're still engaged. At least they still want something better than leftism.
That was way better than my closing statement. So.
Yeah, this has been like the Red Devil and like the Angel over here. I balancing out the show. But we'll leave it there. Ben Domage, TheFederalist.com. Lachlan Marquet, FreeBeacon.com. Thanks for joining us. To everyone watching, thank you for joining us. You can find us on everyjoe.com, #EJPC, your political safe space. Thank you to Mega Producer Aaron. Thank you to Brandon Moore, through whom all things are possible. We will see you next week. Take care.